Good afternoon. What I want to do this afternoon is talk about Linux. And what I think I'd like to start with is what I call Linux prehistory. And it was in 1911, 100 years ago, that Rutherford announced the discovery of the atomic nucleus by scattering alpha particle beams off gold foils. And it was just a few years later, in 1927, that Rutherford, actually in his presidential address to the Royal Society, made a strong request for higher energy nuclear probes than the alpha particles that he'd been using. And this is the statement that he made. "It has long been my ambition to have available for study a copious supply of atoms and electrons which have individual energy far transcending that of the alpha and beta particles from radioactive bodies. I am hopeful that I may yet have my wish fulfilled." So his statement actually became a challenge to invent higher energy particle accelerators. The race for higher energy particle accelerators involved an early competition between the electrostatic machines, which were simpler, basically. But electric breakdown was a fundamental limitation to getting high voltages that they needed. Meanwhile, it had already been realized by a few that another solution that avoided very high voltages was available, and that was to use time-dependent accelerating fields. And the first person to really try to do this was a Swedish physicist, Gustav Ising. In 1924, he published an accelerator concept with voltage waves propagating from a spark discharge to an array of drift tubes. These voltage pulses arrived sequentially at the drift tubes, producing accelerating fields in a sequence of gaps. Some of you can see this picture. I'm going to just try to describe it so you get a feeling for what this idea was. So what we have here is a glass tube, which was the vacuum tube, and the beam goes from left to right. And the key thing here is that there are three drift tubes. These are metallic drift tubes. He's showing some particles in here at a time when the particles are actually inside the drift tubes. And the thing about the drift tubes is, of course, that they're shielding the particles on the inside from external fields. Now, what happens is the following. If you look down here, there's a circuit down here. And for those of you who can't see it, there's a capacitor. And the capacitor gets charged up. And when it gets to a high enough voltage, there's a breakdown of the spark gap that's shown by these two dots here. And three voltage pulses propagate away from this spark discharge. And he's arranged this so that the voltage pulses from drip tube one gets there first, drip tube two gets there second. It's coming from this, from A2. And then this cable here brings, finally, the third drip tube. Now, what happens is that when the first drip tube receives this pulse, this voltage pulse, the one on the left, the voltage pulse coming to the second drift tube, it hasn't gotten there yet. So there's actually a potential on the first drift tube, and the middle one is the center one here is grounded. So that means there's an electric field, an accelerating field, between drift tube one and drift tube two. And when the particles come out of that drift tube, and they enter the gap, they see the field and they get accelerated. Then they go into the second drift tube, and the same thing happens again. The cable brings to the second drift tube, it brings another voltage pulse. The particles, when they get into the gap, they see that voltage pulse, and so on and so forth. And that was the idea. And nobody could really see anything wrong with it. The trouble was that Ising, who published this in 1924, he was unable to demonstrate the concept experimentally. He had problems. Now, the interesting part of this story, I think, is the next fellow that comes along here. This is a graduate student, 1927, Rolf Widerøe, a Norwegian graduate student at Aachen University in Germany, and he's looking for a thesis. And everything he'd tried so far, nothing was working. But he managed to discover, by going to the library, Ising's 1924 publication. He did not believe it would work, and that's because the spark gap arrangement and the traveling waves that had to travel on these cables met with, problems. First of all, there was attenuation, but even worse than that, once the voltage pulses hit the drift tubes, there was a lot of reflection. And also there was coupling between the three different drift tubes. So he didn't think it was going to work. But he simplified the idea by replacing the spark gap arrangement with an AC oscillator, which he did believe that would work. And there's a picture here. That previous picture was from Ising's publication. This picture is from Widerøe's publication. And what happens here, we've actually got five drift tubes, and you can't see too well, but the outer ones and the one in the center are grounded. And then there are two here that are connected to, it's an oscillating voltage source, just showing use of G, it says, or use of B, I guess. But the main thing is that we've got four gaps here, and he arranges this so that there's acceleration in every gap. He does that by making the by having the gap-to-gap spacing equal half an RF cycle, which is just in half an RF cycle the polarity changes, and so the particles always see an accelerating field in every one of those gaps. And Widerøe was quite confident that this would work. And he demonstrated it experimentally in 1928. He applied a 25 kilovolt, 1 megahertz AC voltage to the drift tube between two grounded electrodes. He decided to keep it simple, and so he just had one drift tube with the two grounded electrodes. The beam experienced an accelerating voltage in both gaps, and he was able to accelerate sodium and potassium beams, and he was able to measure their energy, 50 keV kinetic energy, equal to twice the applied voltage. That was a big step. It worked. And this is not possible using electrostatic voltages, where there the kinetic energy can't exceed the applied voltage. So this was quite a bit of progress. And actually, Widerøe was fantastic. He was involved in almost every important accelerator advance, although most people did not even know that he was around. So now I find this quote here interesting. It's from a little book, The Infancy of Particle Accelerators. My little machine was a primitive precursor of this type of accelerator, which is now called a LINAC for short. However, I must now emphasize one important detail. The drift tube was the first accelerating system which had earth potential on both sides. In other words, at both the particles' entry and exit, and was still able to accelerate the particles exactly as if a strong electric field was present. Well, together, Ising and Widerøe established really a principle of resonance acceleration, which was a big step in accelerators. Particles can gain arbitrarily high kinetic energy from successive traversals through the same electric fields, same accelerating fields, but with moderate voltages. The particles acquire a small increment with each traversal. There's no basic limit to the maximum kinetic energy. And the method can be applied to linear accelerators and later to circular accelerators, thanks to Lorentz and on synchrotrons. But there were some problems with the low 1 megahertz frequencies, which is what they had at that time. LINACs for faster protons and electrons, which is what people wanted to use to do nuclear physics experiments, it had impractically large gap-to-gap spacings. The gap-to-gap spacing in Widerøe's system is equal to the velocity divided by twice the frequency, or beta lambda over 2, So high velocity particles require high oscillator frequency to obtain a satisfactory energy gain per gap. And at least a few hundred megahertz were wanted, but RF frequencies at that time were no more than 10 megahertz, which is what Lawrence used in the LINAC that he built several years later. Higher frequency microwave sources were unavailable until after World War II, which was a benefit of radar developments for the war. So now let's talk about what happened after World War II, the period of 1946 to the 1950s. Well, interest in LINACs was not that much before the war. Cyclotrons were just a better way to do experiments. But after World War II, the situation changed. The development, it changed for LINACs. The development of pulsed RF sources at hundreds of megahertz and megawatts of power removed the technical barrier for electron and proton LINACs. And furthermore, invention of synchrotrons was actually important for LINACs because synchrotrons need LINAC injectors, so there was a customer there. The LINACs also have an advantage of better beam quality and output beam focus with smaller size and better energy resolution. So there were some definite advantages. And the first proton LINAC was built in 1947. This was by Louis Alvarez. It was at Berkeley. He designed a proton drift tube LINAC 12 meters long and 1 meter in diameter. And he, of course, had worked on radar during the war. So he learned quite a bit. And this first proton LINAC accelerated the beam from 4 MeV, which was obtained from electrostatic generator, to 32 MeV, initially using surplus 200 megahertz vacuum tubes. And he introduced several features. First of all, a copper resonant cavity for better efficiency, whereas the ones of Ising and Ising's concept and Videro did not use that. Loaded with an array of drift tubes and excited in the TM010 power-efficient mode. Later, transverse focusing with quadrupoles and drift tubes were implemented. And here's just a picture I wanted to show you just to see what the field lines are like. But this is a set of drift tubes. You can see that they're increasing as we go to the right, which is because the velocities are increasing. And it shows electric field lines in three of these gaps. They're actually present in all of them, but the drawing only has three. And the electric field is close to the axis, and that provides the acceleration. And then the magnetic field is azimuthal and associated with currents that are flowing longitudinally. And the magnetic field is the same for all cells, but they're just showing the field here. I would like to have gotten a picture of Alvarez's LINAC. There's not a really good one, first of all, but I've got a couple pictures to show you here. First of all, this is an example of a modern DTL, 402.5 megahertz, 4.2 meters, six-cell drift tube LINAC at SNS at Oak Ridge. And you can see here the copper drift tubes. This is the copper cylindrical cavity and the drift tube stems, which are copper. Since the 1950s, drift tubes contain quadrupole magnets for strong focusing. Here's another unusual picture of Alvarez's drift tube LINAC, 12 meters, 0.9 meter diameter. This is all the people, apparently, that were working on the project. And here is the outer shell of the DTL. Now, electron LINACs. The first electron LINAC was also 1947, and quite a bit of work went into this at Stanford. RF microwave sources near 3 gigahertz were available after the war. Again, this enabled the idea of having electron LINAC. And the people mostly responsible at this point were Ginston, Hansen, and Kennedy, who designed the disc-loaded waveguide, which is shown in a drawing on the right here. And it's a stacked array of pillbox cavities. There's a central hole for it. The beam goes left to right, and the cell-to-cell coupling is obtained from the electromagnetic wave enters through this coupler and then goes to the right, and the beam enters through the end pipe and travels also to the right, and the wave transfers energy to the beam. So now, the next period that I want to talk about is the 60s through the 80s, and I would call this advances in normal conducting Linux, which was the major advance here. And we're going to start out with the slack Linux. It's the world's longest Linux, 3 kilometers long. The maximum energy gain was 50 GeV, 2856 megahertz, a room temperature electron Linux. There were three different phases of its operation. Fixed target phase began in 1966. And then beginning in 1989, the electron-positron linear collider, SLC, and this is the first electron-positron linear collider. It's the first linear collider. And then LINAC coherent light source, which is the phase that's begun in 2009, and which uses electrons accelerated from the last kilometer of the LINAC for the world's first X-ray FEL. And there's an aerial view of the 3 kilometer, 2 mile LINAC. The structures in that LINAC, well, the main structure is this 10-foot disc-loaded structure. It has 86 cells per structure. 960 of these structures make up the slack 3 kilometer LINAC. And here are the cells, which are stacked pillbox cavities, copper. Now, the second major accelerator during this time period is the 800 MeV half-mile LAMP proton LINAC at Los Alamos. It began operation in 1972 as known as LAMP, Los Alamos Meson Physics Facility. It's a high current pion factory for nuclear physics studies with pions. And now it's the Los Alamos Neutron Science Center, or LANCE, a spallation neutron source and a proton radiography facility. And one of the reasons that I wanted to show this is because of what I would call a major innovation for LAMP, which was the invention of the side-couple LINAC for acceleration of high-energy protons or high-energy particles in general. The first 100 MeV acceleration in this machine is coming from the Alvarez drift tube LINAC. But from 100 MeV to 800 MeV is the side couple LINAC. Now, the thing about this is interesting are these coupling cells, which you can see on the top here and on the bottom. The side cavities provide the cell-to-cell electromagnetic coupling, and that permits the on-axis accelerating cells to be designed for maximum efficiency. So there's a picture right here for those that can I hope you can see this, but anyway, let me try to point out the features here. This is a cutaway view so you can see what's going on. There's two kinds of cavities. Now, the beam is going from left to right through this, and these are the coupling cavities, and they couple the electromagnetic energy. But because they're pulled off to the side, it makes the optimization of the cell that's doing the accelerating, which is this one right here and this one next to it, it's available for optimization in a way that wasn't the case before. That results in a spherical shaped structure with reentrant cavity, and you end up with a very efficient structure. And the side couple LINACs are actually used for commercial electron LINAC X-ray generators for cancer therapy. They deliver something like 4 to 25 MeV electrons. There is a picture here that's it's as if we had transparent walls, but right here is this copper-looking LINAC, which is side-couple LINAC. And the reference I found about how many of these are available in hospitals was about 5,000. And 5,000 side-couple LINACs used in hospitals worldwide because of their high efficiency. So that's a big spin-off. And I'll come back to that point later. Now, this the next step here, and I would say this was a major innovation, was the invention of the radio frequency quadrupole, or the RFQ, by the two Russian scientists, Kapchinsky and Teplikov. They published their paper in 1969, and it was sort of unknown it was in the Russian literature, but it was sort of unknown in the West for about 10 years until the ID was finally discovered. It consists of four veins that we can see in the picture on the right, four veins in a cylindrical cavity. There are no drift tubes needed in this. You can see the four veins here. The beam is you can see the beam indicated. It uses the RF electric field for bunching, acceleration, and strong transverse focusing for low-velocity ions. It does all those things. The accelerating fields are obtained from a modulation pattern on the vein tips, on the four vein tips. You can see the wiggles on those vein tips, and that's what ends up giving you an accelerating field along the axis. And the strong electric focusing is better for low-velocity particles than magnetic, because the magnetic force is weaker, of course. The strong electric focusing produces a large increase in the beam current limit for ion linux, and in practical cases that I'm aware of, you can get a factor of 5, for example, better, focusing and larger beam current limit. And all new ion linux now begin with an RFQ at the front end. So it's been a major step forward for ion linux, especially for high current ones. Now here's an example. This is the Bear RFQ. It was a project beam experiment aboard a rocket, is what that stands for. It's an H- RFQ operated in space for SDI Missile Defense Program in 1989. This RFQ is now in the Smithsonian in Washington. It's actually at Dulles Air Force, where they have the space part of the museum. But this is a meter long, 30 keV, 425 megahertz, 30 milliamp H minus is what it accelerated. And it's a very compact 1 MeV accelerator that can carry high currents. But most RFQs are actually quite compact, but this is an example of one that is not, I would say, compact. This is the most powerful RFQ, is the 350 megahertz, 8-meter long CW RFQ that accelerated 100 milliamp proton beam at Los Alamos. LEDA stands for Low Energy Demonstration Accelerator, and this is for the APT project and ATW as well. And it accelerates the beam from 75 keV to 6.7 MeV. Here's the injector shown here, and the RFQ, this is eight meters worth, and it's completely surrounded by cooling coils and waveguides, and so it's actually hard to see if you get down there. But it was quite an impressive result. Okay, now, the next time period. I think it's 1990 to the present, and I think this is the growth of RF superconducting linux. Again, a big step for linux. Well, first of all, why do people want to use RF superconductivity for linux? Well, there are several attractive features. First of all, high accelerating gradients, and they've been increasing from R&D advances. Secondly, high Q values, about 5 orders of magnitude higher than copper. This results in reduced capital and operating costs. And the beam aperture can be increased without the loss of efficiency, which reduces the risk of beam loss and radioactivation, especially for very high current machines where you don't want to be losing the beam. And it helps to have that larger beam aperture. So, RF superconductivity benefited from pioneering work in the 70s and 80s and actually continued also into the 90s. And unfortunately, there are a lot of institutions that worked on developing these, and I don't have time to credit everybody. I'm sure I'm going to miss some people here. But first of all, the superconducting split-ring niobium resonator is the one I want to show here. And this is for the Atlas Argon National Laboratory machine. This is the machine, the Atlas machine, is the world's first superconducting heavy ion accelerator, produced the first beam in the late 1970s. And we're seeing here two drift tubes, that if you can see those, niobium, and they're connected together by these two inductive loading arms, or these rings that you can see, and connected to the base. And this is a two-gap structure. And the accelerator was based on independently phased cavities, which was a new idea at that point, and it involves these structures. Well, the decision to build a superconducting machine for CBAF, I think, was a major step forward for acceptance of RF superconducting LINACs. I've got a little sketch here of a picture here of CBAF, but it's a five-pass recirculating CW electron LINAC. Uses two superconducting electron LINACs, one here and the other across the way from it, joined by magnetic transport arcs. It's now being upgraded from 6 GeV to 12 GeV with 7 cell niobium cavities. Here's a picture of the new cavities. The old cavities had 5 cells. So this is the CBAF 7-cell niobium elliptical cavity. And CBAF began operation in 1994, but I think that was a big advance, that decision. And here's the SNS superconducting LINAC. It accelerates H- from 0.186 to 1.1 GeV. Before the 0.186, there's a drift tube LINAC and a couple cavity LINAC and an RFQ, normal conducting. That's the superconducting part is what I'm showing here. 1.1 GeV H- SNS LINAC and incorporates the world's first H- superconducting proton LINAC. The duty factor is 6%. And it's built with these two structures. These are compressed longitudinally. They're elliptical structures like we saw for the beta equal 1 before for the electron machines, but they're compressed because of the lower velocity of the particles. So 6-cell, 805 megahertz, medium beta is the top one, and the next one is underneath is beta 0.81 structure. And there are about 80 niobium cavities in the machine. Well, I think LINACs have a great future. I tried to look at the projects that are going on, and I was quite surprised that so many involve LINACs. Now, there are five that I've listed here in red. And these are machines that are, they're either, if not approved, these are approved projects. And some of them are underway right now. And then I've got some purple labeled particles that have a serious potential of becoming projects. So what are these? The Facility for Radioisotope Beams, FRIB at Michigan State, the European X-ray FEL, Hamburg. The Michigan State startup is 2020. The construction began 2009 at DAISY for the X-ray FEL. Then we have the European Spallation Source, ESS, in Lund, Sweden, operational in 2025. That's a proton LINAC. Then we have JPARC in Japan, which is under construction, and Spiral 2 facility in France. Then for projects that have, I think, significant potential, the ILC, Proton LINAC-Driven Nuclear Reactor, ADS, and Project X Fermilab. And I just wanted to show this picture of the Facility for Radioisotope Beams because there's a feature here that's different. The LINAC is folded, and I know it's probably difficult unless you're sitting pretty close here, but there's the beam is injected, and there's segment 1, and then it's bent around, and section 2, segment 2 that is, and then it bends around again for segment 3, all to save space and cost. And it's still a LINAC. ILC, I just wanted to mention because of the numbers here. Proposed electron-positron collider, 0.5 TeV center of mass, 16,000 niobium cavities, 31 kilometers long. That's the, and here, this is the cavity. It's a 9-cell cavity. The accelerating gradient is supposed to be 31.5 megavolts per meter, 1.3 gigahertz RF frequency. This picture here is kind of interesting because it's the colliding geometry, and it shows a football field here, and the scale is completely off. I just take some quick numbers, and you can see that the machine is 300 times as big as a football field, not as shown here, so this is magnified. Well, just to summarize, LINACs are used for at least 5 projects now under construction or approved, as well as potential projects, ILC, Project X, and ADS, and I'm probably missing some other ones, but these are the ones that I was able to find. Almost all of these are superconducting LINACs. Only one is not. That's a JPARC. LINAC performance has continued to improve from clever inventions like the side couple LINAC, the RFQ, and advances in RF superconducting technology. And finally, thousands of electron LINACs are now in hospitals around the world for radiation therapy, an application that represents one of the most significant spin-offs of basic research. And that's the end. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Yes. Yeah, maybe I should add a 2 comments. So the first one is, as a project are using LINAC, the one type is a muon collider. They are use LINAC to access the muon. And the second is electron-ion collider. There are 3 designs, LHEC, ERIC, and EMC use the LINAC to accelerate the proton. The second comment is actually another interesting topic is the energy recovery LINAC.
Yes, right. And I knew about I half an hour, I had to pick a few things, but I think those are very good points, so thank you.
Thank you, Yvonne. Any other questions? Yes, please.
So, do you mean by waste stream mutation, you're talking about nuclear wastes, or what do you
mean? Nuclear. Yeah, this is accelerator. Well, it's accelerator-driven systems, and the goals are may not be the same in all cases, but certainly trying to transmute the waste is one of the goals.
And that scales, that would work with the amount of waste that we have?
Yeah.
Other questions?
I was intrigued by this accelerator on a rocket. Is it declassified what Ronald Reagan wanted to do with the 200 MeV beam in a rocket? Or
200, it was a 1 MeV.
1 MeV, sorry.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
does the 1 MeV beam do in orbit?
It orbited, it was about 5 minutes. And the basic program had to do with discriminate, what was called discrimination, discriminating the rockets, the real missiles from decoys, and so it was part of the SDI program.
I have a question.
Thank you. Oh yeah.
So so you split the periods based on the technology that was used for the LINAC development. For example, from 90 to now is superconducting RF technology. So what is it from now to the future, do you think, for LINAC?
Well, I don't think I can answer. It's hard. I think Yogi Berra said it's really hard to predict the future. But I think the RF superconductivity is going to get a lot of development. I mean, I would think with all of these machines, that's going to be a big factor, and that would be nice if that could lower the cost. So that would be an attractive goal, to try to lower the cost, I think, for all the machines. But certainly certainly for ILC is a big issue.
A big issue.
Right.
Okay. Thank you very much again.